This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and our special guest today is Richard Duncan. Richard is the author of three books on the global economic crisis, including the international bestseller, The Dollar Crisis, Causes, Consequences, and Cures, which forecasts the economic crisis of 2008 with extraordinary accuracy. Since beginning his career as an equities analyst in Hong Kong in 1986, Richard has served as global head of investment strategy at ABN, AMRRO Asset Management in London, worked as a financial sector specialist for the World Bank in Washington, D.C., and headed equity research departments for James Capel Securities and Solomon Brothers in Bangkok. He also worked as a consultant for the IMF in Thailand during the Asia crisis. He is now the publisher of a video newsletter, MacroWatch, which can be found on his website, richardduncaneconomics.com. I recommend this website, and he has offered our listeners a 50% discount coupon. If you get to his website, the word to use for the discount is river, and I think you'll find out in the next 50 minutes why I recommend it. So, Richard, welcome to our show.
Bruce, thank you for having me on. It's nice to meet you.
I'll tell you just a little bit of a background, because some of the things we're going to talk about are concerning. And I got married very young at 17, and I read a book called Rough Times Ahead. And it was Howard Ruff who wrote it. And he basically said, we're in for a lot of trouble. This was probably 1970. And he said, if you're a responsible adult and you have a family, you need to have a water supply and wheat. And I bought it. And I bought 1,000 pounds of wheat that I moved for 30 years. And it scared the heck out of me, to be honest with you. So whenever I read other people's opinions, now I take them seriously, but I also come to my own conclusion. I'm sure that you can understand that when people do that, and obviously you do it yourself.
Yes, that's right. And I think that also it's always important to keep in mind that theories that seem to be true at one stage of history in the past may no longer be appropriate for the conditions we're living in today. I think that's important also.
Yeah, that's...
Great economists who had great ideas, say, in 1912 or, 1860, they may have been spot on for their age, but what they prescribed then may not be applicable now.
I agree. For the U.S. economy, after 1980, what usually drove the economy of the United States?
So what we've seen in recent decades is that in the United States, it's been credit growth that drove economic growth. Starting in 1980, credit growth accelerated very sharply in the United States. And what I mean by credit is credit and debt are two sides of the same coin. So you can look at this as all the debt in the country: government debt, household sector debt, corporate debt, financial sector debt. The total debt of the country really began to accelerate sharply. So it had averaged, total debt or total credit had averaged around 150% of GDP from 1950 up through 1980. But after 1980, it accelerated, and the ratio of debt to GDP rose all the way to 370% by 2007. And it was that very rapid credit growth that drove the economic growth. Of course, as everyone had access to more credit, they could spend more and consume more, and it also caused asset prices to go up, so wealth increased, and that allowed consumers to spend more as well. And the sharp increase in credit growth drove the U.S. economy, and the U.S. economy then imported more from the rest of the world, and its trade deficit grew larger and larger year after year. And so the U.S. trade deficit drove global economic growth. And that's the way things worked between 1980 and 2007. But then in 2008, the Americans were so heavily indebted they couldn't take on any more debt. They started defaulting on their debt. They were cut off from new debt. And at that point, credit began to contract, and the world came very close to collapsing into a new Great Depression.
I remember there was a Warren Buffett was on TV, and he was talking about when they were going to pass the $800 or $700 billion package. And he said, honestly, if this doesn't pass, you need to go to your room and get on your knees and pray. And I thought, oh, that was a scary statement.
That was scary. And also at the same time, Treasury Secretary Paulson literally did get down on his knees and beg Nancy Pelosi to pass the bill.
Yeah, that's personally what I did after I heard him say that is I went to Bank of America to try and pull out a fair amount of cash, and I could get $5,000. And it basically an IOU, and there was a line outside that was probably 50 people long with IOUs in their hands to get cash. That was the scariest day for me, worrying about economics.
Yes, I remember that time also. I went to the bank and got gold coins.
I didn't think of that, but I thought cash might be helpful. But you're right, gold coin might have been a better bet. So what has now become the driver of the U.S. economy if it's no longer just the credit growth?
Well, so it's very interesting. Going back all the way to 1950, every time total credit in the U.S. grew by less than 2%, now this is adjusted for inflation, so it's the total credit minus the inflation rate.
Okay.
But every time total credit adjusted for inflation grew by less than 2%, the U.S. went into recession. That happened 9 times between 1950 and 2008.
Okay.
Now, so that's why it's so important to monitor credit growth, because if we don't get it, then we have recessions or worse. And if credit contracts, we go into depression. But what we've seen since 2008 is that credit growth has been quite weak. It's been just really at or above that, I call it the 2% recession threshold, but it hasn't been enough to drive the economy. So what has been driving the economy instead, the Fed has stepped in with, of course, 3 rounds of quantitative easing, and also for a long time, 0% interest rates. And this pushed up asset prices in the United States. So for example, household sector net worth in America, in other words, everything the Americans own minus all the debt that they owe, household sector net worth, in the crisis, it fell in 2009, it was $56 trillion. But by the third quarter of last year, it had practically doubled to $107 trillion. And the reason for that was the extremely low interest rates, pushing up stock prices and property prices, and also the quantitative easing, pumping that new Federal Reserve money into the financial system drove up the asset prices. And so it's now what we are seeing is that it's actually asset price inflation that is driving the economy. As household sector net worth goes up, the Americans feel richer and they spend more money. Their houses become more valuable. Their stock portfolios that they hold directly become more valuable. And then, of course, the money that they have in their pension funds, that all becomes more valuable. They feel more secure, and they go out and spend more. So that has been the principal driver of growth, really, now going on for most of the past 10 years.
Is it the Fed's role now to protect asset prices?
Well, if you watch the most recent Fed press conference from their March FOMC meeting, Chairman Powell pretty much said, yes, it is. Because if the stock prices fall, then credit conditions tighten and consumption slows and the economy goes into recession. So the reason the Fed did an extraordinary about FATES and their policy between the end of December and actually they announced it in January. And they, up until January, the Fed had signaled that it intended to continue tightening interest rates. It was going to continue pushing up the federal funds rate at least a couple of more times this year, if not more than that, and again next year as well. And they were also going to continue with quantitative tightening, which is the exact opposite of quantitative easing. They, instead of creating money and buying assets, quantitative tightening involves them actually selling assets and destroying money. So, but then in December, the stock market fell so sharply that it actually destroyed an enormous amount of wealth in that one quarter alone. I mentioned household sector net worth hit a peak of $107 trillion in the third quarter. But in the fourth quarter, it dropped by $3.7 trillion. In other words, the Americans became $3.7 trillion poorer in the fourth quarter of last year.
Yeah, and I'm a chart lover, too, and I'd never seen that chart. That was pretty amazing.
That's an extraordinary plunge. I mean, in absolute dollar terms, that's the largest drop on record. In percent terms relative to GDP, no, but it's still a very large drop. And by destroying so much wealth, that stock market downturn, that is the reason the Fed in January said, okay, we have changed our plans. We are no longer going to tighten interest rates. We are going to be patient and leave them on hold. And furthermore, we're going to stop quantitative tightening much sooner than we told you that we were going to. And we've since learned they now intend to stop it in September, whereas earlier it was expected to go on probably a year and a half longer than that.
Well, I followed that very carefully because we also have a newsletter, and I remember maybe the October meeting, it was pretty definitive that we're not done tightening. We're nowhere near an accommodate, or we're still accommodative. We're nowhere near where we need to be. And it reversed so strongly, so quickly. I just thought I never would have expected that. Let me ask you this. What would cause the Fed not to protect asset prices? Could there be something more important that they have to go, okay, we have to deal with this?
Well, so the reason Fed policy has been so effective in the years after the crisis, the reason they've been able to get away, for instance, with creating so much money through quantitative easing, as you know, they created $3.5 trillion essentially from thin air in three rounds of quantitative easing in order to push up asset prices and drive down interest rates and stimulate the economy. And it worked. It worked miraculously. That's the reason we didn't collapse into a new Great Depression. But the reason they were able to get away with that, normally and historically, it has always been understood that if a central bank creates a lot of paper money, it leads to high rates of inflation or even hyperinflation.
Right.
But this time it didn't. So why didn't it? And the reason is that we are now living in a very different economic environment than in the past. Today, we live in a global economy with nearly 8 billion people now. And of that 8 billion, 2 billion people live on less than $3 a day. And so what that means is that we no longer have a closed domestic U.S. economy that it just depends on American labor and American industrial capacity. We are operating in a global economy now with an infinitely large labor pool of very cheap labor and extraordinary amounts of excess industrial capacity, particularly in China. So despite the fact that the Fed created so much money, we've been really, deflation has been a greater worry than inflation has been over the last 10 years. And even now, the inflation rate is below 2%, and in the most recent months, it's dropping again. So they have only, this policy that they have pursued has only been possible because globalization has been so deflationary. With globalization, you no longer have to hire someone in Michigan and pay that person $200 a day to build a car. You can hire someone in Western China and pay that person $10 a day. So that has been pushing down wage rates in the United States and the other industrialized countries, and that is completely, that deflationary force has completely offset all the inflationary pressures that normally would have resulted from so much paper money creation. So to answer your question, the one thing that would make the Fed begin increasing interest rates again is if we saw a sudden spike in inflation. If inflation started moving up from 1.5% to 2.5%, 3.5%, 4.5%, 5.5%, well, then suddenly all bets would be off. The Fed would have to start hiking interest rates very sharply in order to bring the inflation back under control. Now, at present, there's absolutely no reason to expect inflation to increase. However, if we were to have an all-out trade war with China and globalization breaks down, for instance, if we put up 25% trade tariffs on all Chinese goods, then things are going to become a lot more expensive in the United States because the U.S. imports so much from China. And that would lead to higher interest rates. So if globalization breaks down and the U.S. economy no longer has access to the ultra-low-wage global workforce, then the cost of everything is going to move up very sharply. In other words, we will return to the era of high rates of inflation that we saw in the late 1960s and especially in the 1970s. And then inflation, then the Fed would have to respond by pushing up interest rates, and that would cause two things that would severely damage the U.S. economy. Much higher interest rates, but first of all, it would cause credit to contract. People just couldn't afford to take on more credit. The reason debt has grown so much since 1980 is because interest rates have fallen steadily, quite steadily year after year to very low levels now. The yield on the 10-year U.S. government bond is only around 2.5% right now, whereas in the early 80s, it was 15%. So as the cost of borrowing became cheaper, the Americans borrowed much more, and that drove the economy. Well, if the cost of borrowing becomes more expensive, then the Americans are going to borrow much less, and credit is going to contract. And as I mentioned, if credit doesn't grow by 2%, the U.S. goes into recession. If credit contracts by 2 or 3%, then the recession becomes a depression. And then secondly, the higher interest rates would cause the stock market to fall very sharply and cause home prices to fall very sharply. So this household sector net worth would fall very sharply. And instead of having a positive wealth effect, there would be a negative wealth effect. The Americans would all feel significantly poor and they would spend much less. And so consumption would drop and the economy would go into severe recession for that reason as well. So you would have two very severe factors dragging the U.S. economy down into a replay of 2008, if not worse.
Okay. How do demographics play into the inflation cycle that we're in? Are the demographics of this world generally deflationary at this point?
Well, it's not so much demographics in terms of the number of people, the growth in the population, or even aging that is the most significant factor. The significant factor is when we went from being a domestic economy, a closed domestic economy, and I think that occurred around to becoming a global economy, everything changed. That happened around 1980, because up until 1980, the U.S. trade balance was more or less in balance. The U.S. didn't have large trade deficits. No countries had large trade deficits or large trade surpluses. Under a gold standard or the quasi-gold standard Bretton Woods system, trade between countries had to balance. But starting in the early 1980s, after the Bretton Woods system broke down, the United States realized it could run very large trade deficits with other countries, and it could finance them with paper dollars or treasury bonds. It no longer had to hand over gold in exchange for its trade deficits. So the U.S. trade deficit blew out from essentially nothing in 1980 to around more than 3.7% of GDP by 1986 or so. And that was something entirely unprecedented for such a large country to have such a large trade deficit. And then it temporarily corrected after the Plaza Accord, when the G7 countries agreed that the dollar would be devalued by 50% against the yen and the mark. Then the trade came back into balance. Then once China entered the global economy in around 1990, the U.S. trade deficit became extraordinarily large. And by 2006, it had grown to more than 6% of U.S. GDP. That was $800 billion that year. And so what this means is that after the U.S. started running large trade deficits with the rest of the world, it no longer had to be concerned about reaching full employment in the United States or reaching full industrial capacity in industries like steel or automobiles, leading to inflation, high inflation in the U.S., because by being able to buy so much from other countries, the U.S. was able to circumvent the domestic bottlenecks in employment and industrial capacity by buying from other countries. And so the U.S. found that it could run large budget deficits, and also that the central bank could create unprecedentedly large amounts of money and without causing inflation in the United States. So this was a fundamental change from really any other condition that we had experienced before.
So demographics, really, you don't really see that as a big factor in, I know Japan has an exaggerated example of that, but the U.S. demographics, you just see that as a minor factor as opposed to what you just stated.
Right. So yeah, in terms of demographics, the big change is you should think of it in terms of what happened to the size of the labor pool. Well, the labor pool went from, let's say, 200 million people in the workforce in the United States, or 150 million perhaps, in 1980. Well, to now, of course, not everybody in the world is old enough to work, but the workforce would be at least 5 billion people now. And so that dwarfs everything else that's happening in terms of demographics, in terms of aging or the number of people. Of course, the number of people in the world is still growing, but at a slower rate than in the past. But in some countries like Japan, the population has started to shrink, and even in some European countries. But from the point of view of the implications for the U.S. economy, those factors are pretty insignificant in comparison, totally insignificant in comparison with this opening up of the global workforce of billions of people who are now willing to work for very low wages.
We've got about 45 seconds left. I'm just going to briefly talk about your website, richardduncaneconomics.com. By the way, this is not usual. We don't usually do this, but I pay attention to a lot of smart people because I have a high school diploma and some street smarts, and there's a lot of what I need. I learn from people that are smarter than myself. My son Greg turned me on to your website, some of your documents, and I appreciate the studies that you've done. And so I would encourage people to go to your website and take a look at it. To me, it's a worthwhile piece to add to the education that we all need to make intelligent decisions.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.